Welcome to the Recovery Stories Podcast, bringing you stories of hope, healing, and triumph over the bondage of addictions, mental health struggles, trauma, and dysfunctional family systems. Our courageous storytellers have chosen to live their journey out loud in order to show others that they don't have to suffer in silence. The stories you will hear are raw, real, and may involve graphic and triggering content. This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health's Rooted Alumni Community. If you or a loved one are struggling, have questions, or are ready to take the next step, call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promisesbehavioralhealth.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
Welcome to Rooted Recovery Stories. My name is Patrick Custer, and I'm your host. I am thrilled to introduce our next guest spotlight in observance of Mental Health Awareness Month. But before I do, I'd like to provide a trigger warning for our audience that this episode includes topics discussed of a sensitive nature, including rape, incest, drug use, abuse, and neglect. We ask that you proceed with caution. I'm thrilled to introduce to you our next guest spotlight in observance of Mental Health Awareness Month. Actress, musician, and recovery advocate. I feel like I'm limiting you on so many of the other things. Wonderful mentions about who you are. Mackenzie Phillips, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Patrick. It's great to be here. And hello to everybody out there.
Absolutely. You know, I wanted to kind of kick things off as if we were approaching this interview for anybody who may not have, you know, been around or know the decades past of the fame, fortune, and rock and roll that you were thrust into as a child. But I think it helps to establish, you know, we oftentimes in the rooms of recovery talk about skipping past the war stories and getting to the solution really fast. And not that I ever say, oh, that's not a good idea or what have you, but on our podcast, I think one of the our goal is to help people identify and listen and hear the nitty-gritty of what people's story was, what their struggle was, where they came from, because for so many who are still struggling and seeking, or maybe not even seeking yet, you know, stumble across this, mm-hmm. The thing that they can identify with is are those, you know, the maybe.
I'm with you, because if you're telling the rooted recovery story, you're talking about the root,
yes.
Right? You've got the roots there, and then you climb up the tree, and then you get to all the beautiful branches that recovery has so freely given.
Absolutely. Yes. And I love that I love a metaphor. That's why we called it Rooted. And
really?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I got yeah. it. I understood yes. the assignment.
Yes. I love it. So, okay. So let's just start off from the beginning, right? So you were born into this family. And could you just share a little bit about the parents that you were born with and that period of life?
You know, everybody has a story, and everybody comes into this world in some sort of, you know, crisis. I mean, birth in itself is traumatic, right? I was born in 1959. I'll do the math for you. I'm going to be 63 this year. And seems like an awfully long time ago when I think about it in terms of numbers. But when I think about it in terms of me, I'm very, it doesn't seem, you know, doesn't seem that long ago. A lot of it doesn't seem that long ago. Mm. Time is, my son once said, he said, Mom, stop worrying. Time is just a measure of the sun. And I'm like, who are you? You're 13. He was like, at the end of the time. But, you know, I was born in 1959. My mother was, a debutante type socialite, Susie Adams. And my dad was John Phillips. And they were from the other sides of the tracks. Completely other sides of the tracks. And my mother met my dad, John, in high school, and they were dating. And my grandmother, she was very fancy, but she was also really mean and an alcoholic. And she hated my father. And she sent my mother away to finishing school in London. The place was called the Club of the Three Wise Monkeys. And all my life, I've been so drawn to the three wise monkeys. And here are my little three wise monkeys: speak no, see no, hear no evil. And I've often referred to myself as the fourth monkey, feel no evil. But my mom was sent away to boarding school. She came back and promptly got pregnant and married my dad. And I was born in 59. When I was born, my dad was in Cuba fighting for Castro.
Wow.
Just saying. He was a rebel, and he went on. My parents, you know, I was conceived during a one-night reconciliation. And I sort of grew up with my mom, and my father was this sort of magical figure because he became a huge rock star. He was the founder of the Mamas and the Papas, you know, Monday, Monday, California Dreamin', All those songs my dad wrote. And he left my mom for a 16-year-old girl who he ended up marrying, Michelle Phillips, who became my evil stepmother and the mother of my adorable and wonderful sister, China Phillips. But I was born in Alexandria, Virginia, and at the age of 6 or 7, my mom, my brother, and I moved to Los Angeles. I just looked up and I saw this on the wall of my office. This is me and my mom.
Wow.
The day that we were flying to move to Los Angeles. And yeah, there's my little mommy. But
you're such a cute little kid.
I was pretty darn cute. I cut my own bangs. I cut them all the way up here that time.
I think I had a few stories like that as well from childhood.
I still cut my own bangs, but much longer. I know how to do it now.
Yeah.
But, you know, I grew up in a very difficult and complicated reality. My mother was sit up straight, know which fork to use, no white after Labor Day, only cross your legs at the ankles, be like the queen. And my father was like, hey, kid, you want to smoke a joint? You know, and it was a very dualistic reality from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And so I became very, very comfortable with when you're here, you're this way. And when you're here, you're that way, which spells trouble. It just spells trouble. And, you know, it is still sending me texts.
It's okay.
Okay. So I could go on forever about this part of my life, but I don't know where you want to go from here because I grew up in a very complicated, weird thing. You know, I would go to my dad's house on the weekend. There would be like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones in the living room. And then I would go home to my mom on Sunday and then have to go to school Monday morning and be a kid again. And I wanted out. I wanted out, and I was mad, and I wanted to live with my dad, and I wanted whatever he had. I wanted that.
Why'd you stay there?
At with my your mom's?
Yeah.
I didn't want to leave her alone. She had an abusive husband, and I felt like I would be abandoning her if I left. But it became so scary over there to the point where this very large, very scary man was screaming at me, and I'm a little girl crouched in the corner. Mm. And so I ran away and I went to live with my dad. I did stay for a long time, and I left my mother with the big bad wolf, and that ended up being a really bad thing, and he beat the crap out of her, and it was just bad. And I helped her divorce him, you know, eventually when I was like 18 years old.
Would you say that was the first time that you really made a hard decision to protect and stand up for yourself in your life, like one of those big pivotal moments?
I think probably. I mean, you know, when my mom passed away in June of 2016, and I went through all of her things, I found all of these notes that I'd written as a child, you know, and it was like, I hate him. How can you be with him? I'm leaving. You know, I don't want to be here. And so I think I had tried to advocate for myself, but I didn't know how. All I could do was attack. You suck. You're mean. I hate you.
Yeah.
And then came to the time, like what happened was my brother, Jeffrey, my older brother, only by like 18 months, knocked on the window of my bedroom because there was like a fire escape and a ledge where we used to sneak out all the time. He had his saxophone around his neck and a bunch of albums under his arm. And he said, I can't take this anymore. I'm moving to dad's. And this was like 3 o'clock in the morning. He knocked on the window. And I thought, oh my God, I'm now all alone here. I have to protect my mom and I have to stay. And I stayed until I couldn't. And then I did. I made the decision to keep myself safe. But then I walked into complete lack of safety. So there was nowhere safe.
Right. Yeah. So what was the picture like when you got to your dad's house? Like if I could tell anybody, like, go read, I haven't gotten to your second book, but your first book that you released.
Was it
2009?
Yeah.
So good. I really, really enjoyed that. And so anyway, I encourage anybody, go read both books, but especially that first one was so, so great. And you describe everything so colorfully. And I mean, you're telling your truth, but it's also thoroughly entertaining for somebody who's grown up in a boring, you know, like suburban life, you know, could you paint the picture a little bit for what that like when you're walking into that life with dad?
Well, you know, I put all my stuff in a shopping cart and I pushed it over to my grandmother's house. And, you know, she when I ran away and she lived nearby in Tarzana, California. Believe it or not, there's actually a town named after Tarzan.
Oh, wow.
And I lived in Tarzana and my dad lived in Bel Air, which is very fancy. So I pushed my shopping cart over to my grandmother's house and I said, I'm running away. Can you call me a cab? And she said, I was 12. And she said, sure. Do you want a beer? So this is the way I grew up. So I said, sure. And my grandmother called me a cab and I took the cab. I mean, she just called me a cab. And I say these things and then I think, did that really happen? Who would do that? You know, but yes, it did. And she did. And I showed up at my dad's house, which was like a palace, but it was a palace where, you know, we had a chef, a cook, but there was no food in the refrigerator. We had, you know, there were like broken instruments on there, but it was beautiful, but it was also sort of a version of Poor Little Rich Girl kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I knocked on the door or I rang the bell or whatever it was. And my dad came to the door in like a velvet floor length rainbow dyed caftan. And he had like a Jesus beard and like hair my length. My hair is quite long. Mm-hmm. And he had a joint in his hand. And I said, I'm moving in. I've run away from mom's. Can you pay for the cab? And he said, sure, kid, whatever turns you on. And that's how it started. And I said, you know, greetings, hello, you're here. Here's your room. And I said, so what are the ground rules? Like, what's expected of me here? And he and his wife, Genevieve, said, well, you have to come home at least one night a week. And if you come home after the sun comes up, make sure you bring a change of clothes with you because a lady never wears evening clothes during the day. And I was like, what? Oh, wow. I'm on my own. I'm on my own. I was completely free range. Their bedroom was in one wing of the house, and my brother and I had bedrooms on the other wing of the house with separate staircases. So, you know, we rarely crossed paths unless I got caught stealing drugs from them, from their room. You know, it was wild. It was wild. And let me say this, that the framework around which my story, in which my story exists, will look very different from yours, likely, or anybody listening. But what was going on internally is something tremendously relatable. I was always frightened. I didn't know if I was safe. And I began doing very risky things at a very young age. And it's really hard when you come from privilege to speak of neglect, because people are like, you lived in a mansion. Your dad had Rolls Royces. There was a right. chef. You know, he was a rock star. You had whatever. But my needs weren't met. Mm-hmm. And so the outside and the inside were very different things.
Isn't that, they talk about a metaphor that, that can be so true when even just talking about our beings, our personal selves, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Gosh. So.
Like on the outside, I'm a 63-year-old woman almost, but on the inside, I'm still 25.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, incongruity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, I can't help but wonder when you walked into, you know, to this new lifestyle with dad, and again, you're presented with this dichotomy that you're referencing of, okay, these are the only rules and this feels kind of weird. Is it right or is it wrong? I kind of like it, but I'm also terrified.
Yes.
Is that a great way to describe it?
Absolutely. It's like, you know, after you get what you want, you're like, oh, wait, is this what I really wanted?
Mm-hmm.
Because I would go there on the weekends and I would visit and, you know, and then my brother was living there and I was like all alone and I wanted to be there. And it seemed like it would be so much fun to live that all the time as opposed to just on the weekends. I didn't know that I would have to hitchhike to school, you know, or just all myriad of distressing events that happen. But, you know, I really wanted to be there. I don't know where I wanted to be. I just didn't want to, I didn't have a home.
Yeah.
You know,
that's the thing that I think that a lot of people can identify with, not feeling at home where they are, whether it's in their body or in their physical space.
You know, as I was coming to work this morning, I was, you know, I'm in my house and I live with my 35-year-old son. It's a big old house. We can come and go as we like. And, you know, I've had this home for almost 22 years. And, you know, as I'm getting ready for work, I'm thinking, oh my God, I can't wait to get home. And I haven't even left yet.
Mm-hmm.
Home has become a sanctuary to me as opposed to a place where I wonder if I really belong there over the years.
Yeah. Wow. So I wanted to ask you next about what your first experience was doing drugs.
Okay. Like,
yeah. How did that door get open for you?
Well, there I was, you know, from the time I was a small girl, right after this time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were adults using drugs and alcohol everywhere, like all mm-hmm. around me. And so the first time I drank was when my brother and I were still living with my mom. Well, not the first time, but the most memorable time. Like my mom would have cocktail parties, you know, she totally looks like a woman who would have cocktail parties, right?
Yeah.
She
yeah.
had cocktail parties and my brother and I would go, don't worry, mom, you go to bed. We'll clean up. And we would take all the leftover drinks and mix them together and drink them, you know, and we were children, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were little kids. And I remember one day my brother said, let's cut school. I've got a bottle of tequila. And we went, I was like, okay. And I think it was 11 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to hang out behind a store that was right up the street from my mom's house. And I remember he had a bottle of tequila and a bottle of root beer. Blah. And
sounds terrible.
Oh, it makes me feel nauseous thinking about it. So he said, first you take a sip of tequila and you swallow, but then really fast drink root beer and you won't taste because tequila tastes horrible. And I got so drunk and I vomited and I actually pooped in a trash can. I mean, like it was like,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And the thing was, I couldn't wait to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
because there was like a when I was a very little girl, like little, like in that picture, mm-hmm. I always thought there is something inherently wrong with me, and everybody knows it, but everyone's treating me like I'm normal. That was the recurring thought of mine. And I don't have that thought anymore, but I carried it for many years.
Yeah.
And when I was, you know, behind that store drinking tequila and root beer, I didn't feel that way. Mm-hmm. I was like, I am tough and I'm powerful and I'm strong and I'm whatever I was thinking. I wasn't thinking there is something inherently wrong with me. Everybody knows it, but they're treating me like I'm normal. And you know, this is something we hear all the time. My first drink, oh my God, I felt okay for the first time ever. So that was the first time I drank alcohol. The first time I used drugs. Well, I mean, my stepmother Genevieve used to say when I would come to their house in Malibu after, you know, the week, and I'd been there the previous weekend, mm-hmm. go, oh, here comes the little thief, because I would have like stolen their weed or whatever. But I remember we were living at the Chateau Marmont Hotel on Sunset Boulevard, and well, they were living there, my dad and Genevieve, and my brother and I came to visit for the weekend, and there was this big bowl of white powder on the table, and they were, you know, using it. And then they put the bowl into the entertainment center under the TV and went to take a nap. Okay. And my brother and I were sitting there, and he goes, just wait. And he pulled it out, and we did the cocaine together. And, like, it was like zing, you know, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And, and then I became the little thief, not of the weed, but of the cocaine. And I brought it to school in the sixth grade. And I got caught with it, but then I told them it was chalk.
Did they believe you?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. They believed me. I said, oh no. Cause it was in a little silver. I stole the little silver box with the little spoon on a chain.
Oh.
And it was, I had it on my desk, and, you know, I had a briefcase that was open, and me and my friend were doing it behind the thing, and she knocked it over, and there were, my first name is Laura and my middle name is Mackenzie. And Mr. Brousseau was like, Laura, what are you doing back there? And my best friend was Lisa Coleman from Wendy and Lisa from Prince. They were in the Revolution, the band, the Revolution, Prince.
Oh yeah.
So Lisa and Wendy we all went to school together, and Lisa was with me, and we were like, oh, that, you know, cause we did gymnastics at this school, and they were like, oh, we just spilled the chalk for our gymnastics class.
Quick thinking.
Yep. Got away with it. Got away with it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, this had to have been something that, you know, I just think about for, you know, you don't start off doing something like that until you've been exposed to it. So it was normal for you to see and be around at this point, all the drugs, because it was the lifestyle of dad's house, right?
Yeah. So when people say, oh, you know, well, I'm very rigid because I'm a product of my environment, or, you know, people talk about being a product of their environment. And I was completely desensitized to, you know, how when I was, you know, five, I was talking adults down from a bad acid trip, you know. I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time, but in, you know, years later, I was like, oh, that's what was happening. That's what was happening. But yes, I was desensitized to that. And, you know, and I also believe there's credence to the theory of a genetic predisposition.
Yes.
Right. I mean, yes. I come from a long line of people with undiagnosed mental health issues, behavioral issues, rampant substance use disorders that include alcohol. And so, you know, that was it.
So, you know, I have to ask at this point, Because it's the, you know, I always talk about the mental health and addiction, chicken or the egg. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. It matters, but it doesn't matter. If you're saying like, which one, you know, do you treat one versus the other? Mm-hmm. More importantly, no, they both matter just as important.
That's right.
And you know, you can figure out, you know, people argue all day long. Did the addiction cause the mental health, or did the mental health cause the addiction?
And right.
But I think what's interesting to ask from your experience, with the, you know, the unique situation and how you were raised, with family history, did you even have an awareness of a difference between people struggling from mental health disorders that you were exposed to versus psychosis and mania and all of the things being displayed?
No, I remember being a small person and sitting there in this environment and thinking, what makes them think this is okay? I'm a little kid, right? Mm. And I remember very early on being fascinated with what drives behavior, what makes people do the things they do. Mm-hmm. And according to my mother, I came to her and said, I want to be an abnormal psychologist. Now, where I got this language, I don't know. But apparently, that was a term back then. And that sparked, you know, my observations of the world around me and what was happening and how I didn't feel safe sparked a lifelong interest in the science of the mind, behavioral health, what mm-hmm. drives behavior, how do you help someone normalize from the chaos and random events. I didn't really understand trauma, of course, because I sure. was a child. But in retrospect, I can see that, you know, if I have any mental health diagnosis, because I'm not, I don't take meds. I'm not, mm-hmm. I don't have depression. I have anxiety. And I have, you know, a traumatized nervous system mm-hmm. from, complex trauma, not yep. big T trauma, but little, many events over time that build up into this feeling of a lack of safety, which triggers anxiety. Now, mm-hmm. I don't have panic attacks or anything like that, but I'm anxious. I'm just an anxious person. When I was still living in Virginia and I was like five, my mm-hmm. mom said that I just was literally running around like a crazy person and, you know, walking around on all fours and barking like a dog, you know, like a weird little crazy ADHD.
Yeah.
And the doctor put me on Ritalin, and my mom used to put it in my orange juice, and they only kept me on it for a very, very short time because it didn't change me.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the research and the statistics of people who have had medications like that at a very young age that go on to abuse stimulants, the numbers are mind-blowing.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, not funny, I shouldn't use that term. It's ironic. Because I can relate to you there that I, and to this day, struggle with attention deficit disorder. But it was diagnosed as a teenager, medicated, but it's in my genes to be an addict, right? Mm-hmm. And I ended up abusing my medication. And I hear all the time people say, you know, general public say, you know, if you really have ADD or ADHD,
it won't make you high.
It won't make you high. You can't get addicted to it.
People say that all the time. And I'm like, I think you're wrong about that.
That's, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I don't have ADHD. I think my nervous system was traumatized at a very young age. Mm-hmm. And I was operating from a faulty operating system. Because like I can focus on a task for hours. Like I audit charts, I resolve billable hours. You know, I'm here at Breathe Life Healing Center where I'm the director of referral relations. And I've been working here for 7 years and working in treatment for more years than that. And I can literally sit and read a book for 6 hours and not get distracted. So I don't think that component existed, but they were trying to figure out what's wrong with this kid. What is wrong with this child? Which probably fed into me thinking there was something broken about me. Everyone knew it, but they were treating me like I was normal.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's so many things. When I think about your story, I'm like, you could try and draw lines to a number of different things, you know,
right.
Parents splitting up, you know, all the traumas and everything, like it's all compounded. But, so, you know, we've kind of talked about, all right, your perception of the world, mom and dad, the two worlds colliding and then separating, and you're kind of coming into your own of identifying, you know, who you are and what you want to do, and the world's opening. So what kind of happened for you next when I feel like this is the point where you got your first audition, right?
No, oddly, I was still living with my mom when I did American Graffiti.
Oh, okay.
So,
got that wrong.
So I went to a Waldorf school. If anybody knows anything about Waldorf education, it's like a Renaissance education. I was studying Greek and French and Spanish and reading Tolstoy in the fifth grade. Like it was wild. And interestingly, all these many, many years later, my son graduated from Waldorf school, same school that I went to. But while I was there, we had put together, and this is like, you know, I was probably 12. We put together a band in school called Chris, Laura, Adam, and Scott, Laura here, and class.
And love it.
Class. And, you know, we wrote songs about being in prison and eating cold soup and drinking beer. You know, none of us. We were all children of privilege, you know.
Right.
We took it to the Troubadour, which is a very famous club here in Los Angeles, on an open mic night, which is Monday night. And, you know, and my dad was Papa John, and then Adam's dad was the head of Elektra Records. And, you know, so it was a bunch of, you know, little hippie kids who had parents in the industry. And we got on stage and I was the lead singer. And, you know, I'm a good singer. I mean, I always wanted to be, you know, the girl with the guitar. I always wanted to be that girl on stage. And so I was living out my dream. And there was a man in the audience. His name was Fred Roos. He's alive and love him. And he's an icon in the film industry. And he was casting American Graffiti. And he came up to me after my set and said, how'd you like to audition for a movie? And my mom was standing there and she said, excuse me, sir, she's 12. And he's like, I know. I'm wondering if she'd be interested in auditioning for a film that I'm casting. And I was like, oh my God, that would be so cool. Yeah, let's do it.
Of course. Yeah.
So I was still living with my mom. I auditioned and I don't remember auditioning, but I have seen my audition is on one of the DVDs or something, my screen test. And there I am. And I'm looking at this at myself and thinking, why don't I remember that? Like literally, I'd never seen it before. I didn't even know the footage existed, but I auditioned, I got the job. And then I had no idea what we were doing. I thought maybe we were doing an after-school special or an educational movie or something. But let me say a little bit about trauma, because many years later, there was a screening of American Graffiti at the Directors Guild, and George Lucas was there, and Harrison Ford, and Candy Clark, and Cindy Williams, and all of us that were in the film, and I brought my beautiful son, who was probably 9 at the time, and so I was definitely, you know, he was 27 when I was born, so I was a fully grown human, and watching the film, and the executive producer of the film was a man named Gary Kurtz, and I hadn't seen him since we made the film in 1972. And he came up to me afterwards and I said, "Oh my God, Gary, I love you. It's so great to see you. I remember I lived with you when I was making the movie. I lived with you and your wife and kids." And he was like, "Do you remember why you lived with us?" And I was like, "No, I just thought that was how it was arranged." And he said, "No, you got off the plane in San Francisco and we picked you up at the airport and you were 12-year-old girl with your suitcase completely alone." And he's like, "Where's your mother? Where's your," they said to me, apparently, I don't remember any of this. He said, "Where's your mother? Where's your guardian?" And I said, apparently I said, "I don't know. She just put me on a plane." And as Gary is telling me this story, which I literally have no recollection of and still do not to this day, my heart rate started ticking up and my hands got sweaty and I felt a little shaky. And he said, "Yes, we had to scramble to get legal guardianship of you. We almost had to recast the role and send you home because your mother refused to come and be your guardian on the set." And as he's telling me this story, I'm starting to have a trauma response, which shows me that the body keeps the score, which is right here on my desk at Breathe Life Healing Center, a well-worn copy of The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, which tells us that we may have memories, but our body holds the trauma. Mm-hmm. But even when he was describing to me something tremendously traumatic that I literally had no memory of, I started having physical sensations related to the trauma. So interesting, right?
Yep.
I don't remember what you asked me, but that's the story that I thought of.
Yeah, no, that was exactly what I asked. And my gosh, I think reading the book, that was one of the things that just stood out for me so much, because like this constant theme for every child, but especially, you know, as you relay your childhood, is this kid who has everything, but the one thing she really wants and needs, which is to be seen, acknowledged, and
cared for,
protected.
Yes. Yeah.
Out of your reach.
Out of my reach. And, you know, over these many years, I have had to do a lot of work around this stuff so that I could come to the realization that my mom did the best she could. My mom loved me so much. Right up until her very last breath. I wear her jewelry every day. This is my mom's fancy, super fancy sapphire ring with diamonds that I wear
beautiful
all the time because she's with me. She's here. She's here. She's everywhere. And they did the best they could, you know, with, although I won't necessarily give that grace to my father.
Right.
I can't give that grace to him because I just can't.
I want to lead in next to some of that, the next years of, you know, going to live with your dad and what have you. But before we go there, I want to ask, what do you think before your dad, before Mamas and the Papas happened and, you know, the hedonistic, you know, lifestyle launched, did he have a vision for his life? What do you think his aspiration was, his goal, what he wanted to be in his heart?
I don't know what he wanted in his heart. I do know that my father's upbringing was tremendously traumatic with two alcoholic parents. His father lived in the basement, had a bunch of dogs named Buck. All the dogs were the same name.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah. Like five dogs named Buck. He'd go, "Come here, Buck." And all these dogs would come running. You know, I don't know. I know that he suffered a great deal of, early childhood trauma. Do I think that my father held me in his arms when I was born and said, "Oh, goody, a good child. I will drug her and molest her repeatedly once she's older"? Do I think that happened? Absolutely not. Hmm. Absolutely not. And what I've learned is when you are in the orbit of a true narcissist, you will take responsibility for their shortcomings, mistakes, all the horrendous and horrible things that can occur will become your fault. Not because they told you so, but because there's sort of a slippery, slidey way that that type of personality operates. And, you know, and I've also learned that there's no pill for narcissism. It's not like you can take an SSRI and then you're you have a decrease in symptoms of depression. Narcissism is very difficult to treat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's oftentimes people, when they, you know, they say, okay, well, what is the difference between all these mental health? You've got trauma, you've got the all the different things. And then we have the personality disorders and they're off on their own little island.
That's right.
You know, we have therapies that can help. And, you know, hopefully in the future we'll have things to add to that, you know, toolbox.
Yes.
But it's hard. It's very difficult.
It's very, very difficult. And especially when you're like when one idolizes the parent.
Yeah.
And the parent is, and I know this probably isn't a word, pedestalized, you know, and they are tremendously charismatic and absolutely charming, but so destructive. And you don't even know you're being injured. You just don't even know you're being injured. And so, you know, and I think that's, you know, being the little girl who was constantly fascinated with what drives behavior, it makes sense that I'm sitting here in a subacute trauma center as one of the owners and one of the directors. You know, it's like, that makes a lot of sense how things could turn out that way.
Absolutely. But, you know, you think after you stay sober for long enough and life turns out in this, you never would have written it for yourself and thought, you know, this is where you end up.
Exactly.
It's the most beautiful thing and you wouldn't change where you are,
That's
you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think one of the amazing things for me working at Breathe Life Healing Center is that like a couple of years ago, I booked being the season villain on Orange is the New Black. And I went to New York for 4 or 5 months to film season 6 of Orange is the New Black. And I'm sitting there, you know, and Breathe is like, of course you should go. Of course you should do that. And I remained on payroll and all that stuff while I was in New York doing the show because I was sitting in my dressing room every day in my prison uniform, working on the computer, doing my job for Breathe remotely. And so I get to, you know, do things like that and come home to this incredible place where I'm a valued team member. I remember I was doing One Day at a Time, the new version of One Day at a Time that was on Netflix with...
What year was that came out?
Oh God, I don't even know. I mean, I think it got, it maybe 2016, 2017,
okay.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And I was cast as a semi-regular playing a therapist, oddly. And I would go to the set and I would think, oh my God, my whole team at Breathe. And here I am sitting here waiting to rehearse a scene. And God, it's just like, but it was great. I mean, I love it. I love doing that kind of work. But then if I would get wrapped early from work on set, then I would go back to Breathe. And I remember walking in one day in the middle of a conversation that some therapists were having about, how are we going to treat this client? How are, you know, what can we do to shift the course, help him shift the course of his life? And I had just come from one of the most outward focused things in the world over at Sony Studios. And I'd driven back over to the clinic and I walk into this conversation and my whole spirit lights up. Everything. I'm just like, oh, this is where I belong. That other thing can come here and there and I can do that. But I'm always going to come home to working at Breathe. you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's so beautiful. It's one of the gifts of one of the beautiful gifts of recovery, right? That we get the gift of choice today.
That's right. Right?
As long as we keep the first things first.
That's right. Absolutely.
Gosh. So the acting thing, this next phase of your life, you go into, was the one day at a time mm-hmm. period, right? Like yeah. as a teenager, you're yeah. working through and you're working a full-time job doing school. And
yes.
were you regularly doing drugs yet at that point when you started?
Absolutely. 100%. I was a proficient baby addict. And, you know, I moved in with my Aunt Rosie. Bless you, Aunt Rosie. I miss you every day. Who became my father's sister, who became my legal guardian. Mm-hmm. And my mom didn't want to do it. She was doing her thing. And, you know, I didn't talk to my mom for quite a few years because I felt so abandoned, right? And she mm-hmm. felt abandoned.
Right, because you left her.
Exactly. So we both had, you know, pretty good reasons to not communicate. But I was living with my Aunt Rosie, and she was on set with me every day. She went on location with me when I did movies. And, you know, Valerie Bertinelli and I basically went to high school in an office right next to the rehearsal hall of One Day at a Time. And it's interesting, you know, Valerie was sort of this adorable, beautiful, wonderful. We're only 6 months apart in age. Like Valerie yeah. just turned 62. So we're the same age until I turn 63 in right. November. And then next April, we'll be the same age. It's kind of funny. But I was sort of a little jaded and hardened by then already, you know. And the first couple seasons of the show, I was able to keep it together. But then, you know, I moved in with my 35-year-old boyfriend when I was 18, and I was late for work every day. And one day a vial of cocaine fell out of my pocket and I got in a lot of trouble. And, you know, it was very public. You know, my struggles were always very public. And, you know, and I would go to treatment or, you know, and it wasn't like, you know, I think I was sort of prior to the time, I was sort of a pioneer of screw ups, you know,
right.
Because they wouldn't say, you know, we're going to write you out for 30 days and we want you to go to treatment. And then when you come back, you can have your job back. They were like, we're going to suspend you without pay for a month. And we want you to go get well. Just go get well.
Mm-hmm.
So when they did that, I was like, I'm not sure what they mean, but I will get my teeth cleaned and go to the dermatologist, have a haircut and get new clothes. And then I came back, I'm like, ta-da. And they were like, you look great. Fantastic. Mm. So you're back to work. And so, you know, that is the perfect example of thinking that recovery is an outside job. So I was doing everything to make me look okay, but everything on the inside was still in the same state it was when they told me to go take care of myself. And they didn't know any better. They really didn't.
Right.
It was like 1977. They're like, we don't know what's going on. This kid is 16, 17 years old.
Well, everything was a party. And not only that, you were the daughter of a rock and roll icon.
Exactly. And I swear, I just want to be normal.
Mm.
I just like, that's why I love working at Breathe. Nobody treats me other than a team member. You know, Okay. So I have a sign on my door that says live podcasting, do not disturb. You know, I do a lot of things that other people here don't do, but when I walk out of here, someone's going to say, hey, Mac, I've been waiting for you. Can you tell me about, I have a question about the electronic medical records or whatever.
Yeah.
I just want to be
simple, normal. Yeah. 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 Not everybody, I feel like not everybody finds their channel to be able to settle into that after the spot, a life of spotlight like you've had.
I drive a Kia.
Do what?
I drive a Kia. Like I'm a normal person, or at least I I posit myself to be.
Yeah.
Normal. I love my life.
I think
life.
That's awesome.
It's good.
That's awesome. So, you know, the big thing, and there were lots of big things, but, and you kind of touched on it earlier, you know.
Oh, I know where you're going.
Yeah, with your dad. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could set the stage of, like, what was life like leading up to? What was your relationship with him like? You know, what was life like for you and your relationship with him leading up to this point?
Well,
happened.
I can't really say when it happened because I don't know. I don't know. I do know that, you know, I loved my dad. I trusted my dad. I got high with my dad a lot. And I do know that I woke up from a blackout and I was having sex with my dad. And that is my first conscious sort of unconscious, conscious awareness mm-hmm. of what was happening. Mm-hmm. And then I slipped back into the blackout. Mm-hmm. And then my drug use skyrocketed so much after that.
Sure. Because,
you know, it's like, I wanted to wear blinders. I didn't mm-hmm. want to know, you know, mm-hmm. and I told family members and they were like, you can't do anything. You can't do anything because you will destroy your father's reputation and just let it go. Mm. And I went to him. He was living in New York and it was pretty dark times for him. And I mean, not quite as dark for me, at least on the outside. And I said, Dad, you effing raped me. And he said, don't you mean when we made love? And you believe everything's your fault when you are in the orbit of a narcissist.
Right.
And I was
right.
Like, oh, maybe that's.
Sorry. I phrased it wrong.
Yeah. Sorry. Did that upset you?
Right.
And, yeah, it was a very dark time in my life.
Sure. How long was that between, and I know you said it's hard to tell, but like when it actually, like when the specific time frame was, but do you have any idea of roughly how long it was between when it happened and when you confronted him?
I don't know. I do know now that when it happened, certainly could not have been the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But I have absolutely no memory of a previous time, but it just doesn't seem like it could have been the first time. And, you know, it's so uncomfortable for me to talk about this, but I'm talking about it with you.
And I thank you because I know, I mean, it's obviously not the first time you've talked about it. It probably won't be the last, yeah. And I know that I'm sure you do this to help other people, right?
It's only, you know, only.
And I can't help but wonder how many people have somehow a similar story that the shame and guilt is so profound that the trauma.
You have no voice. You have no voice. Mm. You know, I remember when I wrote High on Arrival, and then the day of publication, the publishing house had arranged for me to appear on the Oprah Winfrey show mm-hmm. the day the book came out. And that was probably one of the hardest days of my life, sitting there talking to Oprah and being sort of grilled like they didn't believe me or something. And it was horrendous. And
wow,
I remember framing it as something that became consensual over time. Mm. And then I was absolutely bombarded on social media by people who said, no, there is no consent.
Right.
There is no consent. And I had to rethink it and go, oh my God, I am taking on responsibility for something mm-hmm. that I should mm-hmm. never have been mm-hmm. asked to carry. And so when High on Arrival came out, it was hardcover and, you know, the whole book was beautiful and wonderful. And people think of it as an incest memoir, which of course it isn't. There's maybe 11 pages in there that deal with that, not the entire book. But
right.
when it was going into paperback, I contacted my publishing company and I said, I would like to write an addendum, a closing chapter mm-hmm. for the paperback. And I was allowed to do that. And in which I talked a little bit about what happened after High on Arrival and how I was schooled by hundreds of thousands of survivors across the world mm-hmm. that I was unable to consent.
Right.
And it changed everything for me because, like, this is not my shame to carry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's heavy.
And, yep.
and I'm not going to carry it anymore. It's not mine. And
that's so right.
When people say, you know, people maybe that I know or that I might be related to say, I forgive you for what you wrote in the book. I'm like, I don't.
You had people.
I don't.
You had people say that to you?
Yeah. I'm like, I don't. There's nothing to forgive me for.
Wow.
You know, and so I've had to, you know, and then you know, granted, I was in, you know, 50 when maybe right around 50 when High on Arrival came out. And I want to say I had to grow up. I had to grow up and I lost most of my family for about 8 years. And my son and I were sort of this little island. I mean, with his dad and his dad's wife and, you know, my wonderful friends. But it took years. I said, I will always meet my family with open arms and love.
Mm-hmm.
I will be over here like this while they're over there like that.
Right.
Until we both meet like this. And we did. It took a long time. But I don't need, I don't need anybody's forgiveness. Maybe I need, to forgive myself.
Well, two things I want to highlight there that, you know, for anybody who is here with us now, you know, when you have somebody that's suffering with a personality disorder, like you mentioned, you know, it's you're conditioned to think that if anything happens wrong, it's your fault. It's not the person's fault. Not only that, but the people around the person suffering with the personality disorder are all
indoctrinated, groomed
to protect this person, even if the truth is facing them right in front of their eyes. And even beyond death, right?
Mm-hmm. Even beyond death. Yes. I had someone in my family say, you're going against everything he taught us. And I said, damn right I am. Damn right I am. I will not live under that shadow ever again. And I also had someone in my family say, you want your family back? You need to go on TV and say that you made up everything in the book to get money to buy drugs. And I said, guess I'm not getting my family back then, because that's never going to happen. And you know, you can tell I'm still a little activated about it, but
sure, as I mean, as, you know, as one would be. Yeah, I can't imagine that would ever change. I mean, that how can you can do all the therapy in the world, and I mean, you know,
right?
You
and you know, and my family, they're lovely people, and I love them very much, and I love them from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes me feel safe. And they know that I love them. And we come together and then.
Sure.
You know. I hope I don't get in trouble with them for talking so openly, because I've worked so hard. We've all worked so hard to be at peace with each other, but I think it'll be okay.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's a way of coming together and saying our, you know, our relationship now is more important than, you know, weaving through all the stuff in the past and, and what have you. But that's where the next thing that I thought I really wanted to hone in on with you is because your big theme of your whole journey and story, obviously drugs were, but it's trauma. And so whether you're talking about recovery from addiction, but especially trauma, when we, I always say that, like, I feel like trauma is the stepchild of mental health. When we talk about Mental Health Awareness Month, everybody's thinking like bipolar, depression, anxiety, you know, all that stuff. Hello, trauma is is mental health, and it's, you know, it's often something that is mentioned and spoken of in its own category, but people, it is mental health, and you know, and it happens to all of us. But you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you to talk about is what did the resolution of trauma look like? Obviously we can't go into all of that, but when it comes to life changing and being better, home being a place that you were able to create and somewhere you want to go back to, you're excited to after work, you know, waking up and being excited to see the morning without, you know, and being able to set boundaries and enforce them with family members and figure out that relationships can look a certain way and they don't all have to be, I owe everything to everyone, which is something that I had kind of highlighted to mention. I forgot to mention earlier in your story, a theme that I saw so prevalent in your book was just that from a young age, it seemed like this, I owe it to everyone to be everything to everyone. That's at all times. So how do you shift? If you were to talk about some of the, you know, the big milestones that made such a difference for you to take control of how your trauma was driving your life, what would you say some of those things were?
Well, I have to say, first of all, you are wonderful and adorable, and I really enjoy talking to you. Just wanted to say that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I'm enjoying talking to you too.
Thank you. I want to say that I'm going to tell a story. You know, when I was a child, I felt like I was always sort of chasing around my very energetic, very beautiful mother. And, you know, she was something special. And fast forward many years later, my mom was a member of something called the Motion Picture Mothers. And it was like, you know, Tom Selleck's mother, Bruce Willis's mother, you know, John Cassavetes's mother, Debbie Reynolds, you know, all these sort of very fabulous older ladies with great hats and lots of makeup. And they were a charitable organization that raised funds for the Motion Picture Home.
Oh.
And my mother.
What was the Motion Picture Home?
It's a place for older members of the entertainment industry to live out their years.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah.
And so my mother was a member of this, and we used to go to luncheons, you know, all the time, and we would get dressed up, and here we were, and I wasn't chasing my little mom around. I was a mature woman pushing my little mom in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so bittersweet, right? And, you know, my mom died 18 years sober. And so I went to the bar to get us some Diet Cokes. And this fabulous woman in this amazing hat walks up and she says, "Mackenzie, tell me about your latest project." And I said, "Well, let me explain to you, as I've sort of shifted gears, I've walked into some work that I'm very passionate about, and I'm working with others and you know, I'm a counselor at a treatment center. And she said, oh. And she turned around and walked away. And I thought, I wanted to run after her and go, wait, no, you don't understand. This is the most special thing I've ever done in my life. I get to help people change the course of their lives so that they no longer have to live under the oppression of drugs and alcohol and untreated trauma. But I didn't. I went, oh, she's speaking to me about her expectation of who I should be. And right. I'm speaking to her about the passion of who I'm becoming. And I'll never forget it. I will never forget it. And I thought, I don't need to explain to her how beautiful this is, that I don't have to value myself about what's my next project, that I'm not bound by the entertainment industries. I don't value myself that way, you know? And I still feel kind of weird sometimes when people are like, oh, well, what are you doing now? What are you working on? And I'm like, well, I'm working on myself and I'm working with others all the time. And I'm doing this amazing work. There's still that moment of like, oh, I can't tell them that I have a show coming out because I don't. And that's okay. And so following one's passion, as opposed to what others might expect one to do, to have the expectation, has been so incredibly freeing for me. And really, you know, okay, so also EMDR.
Yeah.
And so EMDR changed my life, and it did it in a very short period of time. I had an EMDR therapist, and we did some work around resetting memories into other, like I used to drive around and I'd have this video loop in my head of horrors, right? And it made me feel stuck and blind and hopeless, right? And so we worked on those video loops, those loops that would run, and they don't run anymore. And they live somewhere else in me where if I want to or need to access them, whether it be for appropriate self-disclosure with a client or speak about them to you, I am, don't end up in a puddle of tears or full of recriminations and shame and guilt. I don't, because it lives somewhere else in me. And really, I took care of my mother in her final years. And she was living in an assisted living, and I moved her to one that was like about a mile from my house. And I spent a lot of time with her, and these things ground me and they bring me joy and they allow me to see my worth and value through the eyes of others as opposed to through my own eyes. And that's something that has been invaluable for me. Not that, I don't mean that in looking for external validation, because it could be construed that way.
Right.
I mean that in an entirely paradoxical way, if you will.
Yeah. Well, because you you spent so much time, if I could say what I feel like I heard you meaning, was you spent so much time of your life looking at yourself through this critical lens.
That's correct.
That was distorted and what have you. This beautiful woman that is sitting in front of me today, that's a miracle. You're getting to see that person that I see, rather than the shame and the guilt and all the things you had been looking through that lens.
Thank you. Yes. What he said, everybody.
gosh, I, you know, something that you were saying just a minute ago just resonated so much with me. And now, of course, I'm drawing a blank on what
That's what the brain does.
Right.
And you're younger than me.
Oh my gosh. I know. I'm not looking forward to this continuing.
The aging syndrome. You know, I spend a lot of time playing very complicated, heavy strategy board games with my son. We've taken a room in our house and we've turned it into the game room, and we play a lot of Euro games. It's sort of a subculture of, I'm a board game geek. And so a lot of what I do in my free time is play very, very complicated board games with Shane.
Wow.
And it has really helped with neuroplasticity. It helps my brain. I'm managing five different things that you need to be able to play this game, and remembering the rules and moving the pieces. Uh-huh. And it's really kind of magical what it's done for my 62-year-old brain.
Well, I can't help but imagine that something is so important. I mean, because I've got some stuff I'm a recovering person as well. And you know, no matter how long your drug usage and trauma may have been, like, it has the potential to cloud your memory, not only cloud the past memory, but kind of befuddle your career. Yeah. And so, I can't help but think that stuff like that is awesome. I can't say that I have started to participate in things like that that help, but I need to. So
it's so much fun. I'm not sponsoring this, but go to boardgamegeek.com and you'll see this world that is very subculture, but it's absolutely magical. And I love it so much.
So awesome. So tell me a little bit about Breathe.
Okay.
Life. I'd love to for our viewers and listeners to understand what it's like there, where you're located, and what makes you so passionate about what y'all do.
Well, Breathe Life Healing Center is located in Los Angeles, and we've been open for over 8 years. I've been here almost 7 years. I started here as a counselor, and then, you know, as I started like my second book came out, Hopeful Healing, and I had to tell my caseload that I was leaving to go on a book tour and that I was handing them over to another person's caseload. And it made me realize that how would I have felt had that happened to me in the multiple times I was in treatment? And it made me realize that, and it also made my employers realize that that was not going to work, but they also wanted to continue to offer me the freedom to come and go as I please. So I, over the years, have sort of worked my way up the ladder to being a manager, now being a director, now being a part owner. But the beautiful thing about Breathe is that I like to call us a subacute trauma center. And we work very closely. We're LGBTQ owned and operated. And we work very closely with what we call the chemsex population, because we see a preponderance of gay men with crystal meth and sex issues. So we have what we call our chemsex track. We have not many people are doing that type of work in the treatment world.
Right.
And so that is one of our specialties, but we also, we do internal family systems work, which is the Richard Schwartz model of, the parts of self that need to integrate. And we're just really good at what we do. We're really passionate about our work, and we have a magical clinical team. And Adrian Glasser is an IFS sort of genius.
Yeah.
Studied under Richard Schwartz, and she facilitates our IFS groups here, and it's pretty it's very meaningful work, and I love what I do. And
awesome.
Breathe is a special place. We also treat eating disorders and, of course, chemsex, SUD. And we're a multidisciplinary team that's actually able to individualize care. A lot of people say that they do that, but they when you get there, they really don't.
That's true.
And we really do. So I love where I work, and it's been, aside from being Shane's mom, it's one of the greatest blessings of my life.
Mm, that's so beautiful. There are so many, I always say it's so funny, and I correct myself because none of it, it's never funny. It's ironic. There are so many treatment centers. When you look at the number of treatment centers in the country, you go, whoa, that's so many. But in reality, you got to cut that number in half, because half of them
aren't
unethical,
and people are dying in their care. And yes.
And so I love that we can highlight the people who are doing the good work like you all. And it's so grateful, because when you come out from the other side of being someone, you know, sick and suffering, and you know just how desperately so much of our world needs this, you know,
I think about the families that are searching for appropriate care, mm-hmm. either their child, their adult child, or, you know, their spouse or their parent. And it just saddens me and frightens me that so many of these vulnerable people with substance use disorders or mental health issues end up at the wrong place.
Right. Yeah. It is sad. It is sad. And a story we hear all too often.
Yes.
I want to take a second to mention that we will have in the show notes all of the ways that you can follow along with Mackenzie, Mac's journey, and her social media stuff, Breathe Life, those links as well in the notes. So if you are someone or you a loved one that is needing help, you know, there are resources to reach out to a trusted
provider.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to say I've got two last things that I know we've gone over a little bit on our time and I apologize, but I just wanted to give a quick shout out to my friend and colleague, Julie Eisen, who connected us.
Oh yes. Thank you, Julie. Person.
Yes. And she is just one of my favorite people and such a light in our world. And thank you so much for your time today and just getting vulnerable and being willing to open up that box that, you know, we were talking about, that is a sacred thing to do. And I am so grateful that you've been willing to do that with us today. I know
thank
that
you.
It's going to speak to a lot of people. And just, I wanted to ask if there's a last word of encouragement, you know, or advice or support that you'd like to leave our audience with, that somebody that may have identified with part of your story today.
Well, I know that when High on Arrival came out and that day that I was on the Oprah Winfrey show, that the calls to RAIN, the Rape and Incest National Network, went up like 87%. And people felt like finally there was someone relatable talking about their own experience. And people wear blinders.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody even wants, blah, 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 blah. Nobody
yeah.
wants to think that this could be real, right?
Yeah.
And I just want to say, the shame isn't yours to carry. You
mm-hmm.
have a voice. You matter. Your inherent worth and value is not up for debate. And so don't be afraid to get some assistance and get some help, because I know how crushing it can be to carry someone else's shame for 30 years.
Mm.
When I was able to speak my truth, things changed for me. Now, I know that a lot of people aren't in a position where they could handle losing their family.
Right.
Because, you know, people don't want to believe us.
Mm.
But if you can find someone to help you let go of that shame, do it. It's worth it.
I couldn't agree more. And with that, I will add how I always close out our episodes and say that it is never too late to start loving yourself, and you're only one decision away from a completely different life.
Oh my God, you're so good. Thank you. I love
it. I can't take credit for that. I stole it from somebody else, but it's, you know.
But the way you say it is all that matters.
Oh, so true. And so meaningful to me. So I share that with you all. And thank you again, Mac, for your time today. This has been a true honor for me.
Thank you. As for me, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And with that, I hope you all have a great day.
For more information on today's episode, check out the show notes. Recovery Stories is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health's Rooted alumni community. If you or a loved one are struggling, have questions, or ready to take the next step, call our admission center at 888-648-4098. Or visit us online at www.promisesbehavioralhealth.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help. Whether you're watching on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please share with your friends, follow, subscribe, and leave us a review. We are grateful for you and hope that you have been encouraged by today's episode. As always, remember you are only one decision away from a completely different life, and it is never too late to start loving yourself.